Okay, hi, this is Steve Heidemann. I'm a senior vice president at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington and have been studying Syrian politics for a very long time.
And this is Joshua Landis. I am an associate professor at the University of Oklahoma and director of the Center for Middle East Studies here. I also write on Syria pretty regularly on a blog called SyriaComment.com.
And what Josh and I decided we would talk about today is Syria's foreign policy, and in particular, Syria's support for Islamist movements in the Arab world, and why a government which is secular and is the result of a political process that brought a government to power that has often been quite repressive of Islamist movements at home would take a position in support of those movements outside of its own borders. And Josh, maybe you'd like to jump in and offer a thought about why the Syrians are adopting this posture that might be seen as a little bit odd for a secular regime.
Well, it's really a product of what's available out there in the Islamic world, and then particularly the Arab world. And let me give you an anecdote. A very good friend of mine who, in the 90s, was sitting with the vice president of Syria, Abdul Halim Khaddam, at his dining room table. His father was a good friend of Khaddam's. And Khaddam made the statement, Syria has to, we have to make friends with Islamic movements because only Islam has liberated any occupied territory. Nationalism has failed. Nationalist movements have not liberated any occupied territory. And that's, you know, I think that is the sort of basic...
I agree. I tend to agree, but I think, you know, the anecdote's a good one. It sort of reflects an underlying principle of Syrian foreign policy, which is it's a challenger state. I mean, it's a state that...
But everybody does this. America...
I'm sorry?
America does exactly the same thing in the Middle East. I mean, we've teamed up with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan because we needed somebody to kill Russians. We've teamed up with Saudi Arabia
because we need somebody to
defend our interests in the region, and who else to go...
But that's the point I'm making, that there is an underlying strategy anchored in Syrian perceptions of its own regional interests. It views its interests as opposed to those of a range of actors in the region, and these relationships with Islamist groups give it an instrument that it feels it can use to advance its interests regionally.
Absolutely. And it's too big.
So, I mean, that's all I'm saying. And I'm not suggesting that Syria is behaving in a way that's at all idiosyncratic or that it's doing something.
The two big groups that it's consistently supported over the last year is, of course, Hezbollah, which is the biggest problem for the United States and Israel. And then, of course, Hamas amongst the Palestinians.
Right.
And those have been consistently backed by Syria in a struggle.
Absolutely, and it's very clear that Syria views its support of those groups as a significant card in its efforts to secure some kind of settlement with Israel that meets Syria's conditions.
Yeah, it's about leverage.
You know, there are some interesting questions about the ebb and flow in Syria's relationship with Hezbollah in particular. There are lots of arguments about whether Syria continues to exert the same degree of control over Hezbollah or has the same degree of influence over Hezbollah that it did during the period of the current president's father, Hafez al-Assad.
Right.
There are arguments about whether, in fact, Hezbollah has become an independent actor, which is exploiting Syrian support but is not under the same degree of Syrian authority as it was in the past. I don't know what your sense of that is.
Well, I think, you know, before getting to these sort of modality questions, the Middle East, unfortunately for most of the regimes that exist there and foreign powers, is the active groups, the powerful popular groups are almost all Islamist. And we see that in Iran. We see that in Palestine with Hamas. We see that in Lebanon with the rise of Hezbollah. We see that in Egypt with the main opposition group to the nationalist regime, which is Muslim Brotherhood. We see that with Al-Qaeda getting so much attention throughout the Middle East. And so if Syria wants to operate and find allies, that are not state powers. It's got to go to these Islamist groups. And that's true for...
But that strategy only makes sense given a certain set of foreign policy ambitions.
Well, but no. But I mean, right? It depends. I mean, America does it. I mean, every regional power has aligned itself with Islamist groups. And because that's all there is. You can't name me a secular group in the Middle East that has any clout with any people.
No, but but we shouldn't take from that that either the motives or the relationships between various regimes and various Islamist actors can all be lumped together.
Well, but I think they're all instrumental. I mean, in a sense, it's not...
Well, absolutely. They're all instrumental. Right. And I think, you know, Syria is an anti-status quo regime in the region.
Well...
It finds itself confronting the Saudis, who have supported a balance of power anchored in more moderate, pro-Western Arab regimes.
I wouldn't go for that nomenclature at all. I would disagree with you in the sense that Syria, in many ways, is the arch-conservative. They were against America destroying the Ba'athist state in Iraq, very conservative. They're against America wrenching Lebanon out of its traditional... position as under the Syrian security umbrella.
Well, I'm not sure I share your sense that there's a natural order in which Lebanon must be subordinate.
Okay, but
to
the
Syria.
Order that's existed but, since the order that's existed there since Syria went in 1976, when the West and Israel invited it in to stop the civil war and to keep the Christian Lebanese from getting massacred. And Syria's been the dominant power there for a long time. Was recognized by the United States for a long time. George Bush tried to change that with his big reform of the Greater Middle East and to wrench Lebanon out. And in that struggle, we saw Hariri get killed. We saw Lebanon...
Well, I think Hariri is the former prime minister yes. of Lebanon who was killed in 2005. But I think you're eclipsing... you're offering a perspective that's anchored very heavily on the events of the past 5 or 6 years. When... The regional struggle for power or efforts to dominate the regional balance of power in which Syria has found itself at odds with other Arab regimes goes back much further than that.
No, Syria went through a revolutionary
and so
period
you can't,
in the 50s
you, or 60s. You can't ignore the history in kind of in an effort to characterize Syria as preferring a particular status quo. I think it clearly did in the period from 2003 onward. It was reacting against
U.S. revolutionary what it
saw
activity.
As trends that would affect the balance of power in the region negatively with respect to Syria's interests. But nonetheless, it does have this very long history, and it positions itself in this way as a leader of what it would regard or what it would define itself, I think, as a resistance bloc within the Arab world. Resistance to Israel.
Right, it is resistance.
Resistance
it is the
to
leader
the West.
Of Arab resistance to Israel.
And that and that has given its relationship to Islamist movements a particular cast. It has sought out actors among Islamist movements, in particular the two you mentioned, Hamas, which is now dominant in Gaza, and Hezbollah in Lebanon, because their worldview, broadly speaking, is consistent with that of Syria. I mean, there is an affinity there.
I agree with you in part, but Syria used to support secular Palestinians when they were the dominant resistance force. As soon as they became flaccid and made peace with Israel and no longer had any real didn't capture the imagination of the Palestinian people, Syria shifted to the Palestinian groups that could fight against Israel and that could help them liberate the Golan Heights, which has been occupied by Israel since 67. And it's really about instrumentality. It's not a shared ideology. The ideology that's shared is resistance.
No, but that's right. No, absolutely. It's not a shared ideology with respect to the desirability of an Islamic government in Syria. I think right. we would probably agree that at home, Syria's treatment of its own Islamists is very different than its relationship with Islamist movements like Hezbollah and Hamas. So absolutely instrumental and absolutely anchored in this shared commitment to resistance, but that has I think provided a kind of rhetorical and other foundation for legitimating these relationships in ways that have helped the Syrian regime avoid the question of hypocrisy, avoid the question of double standards with respect to its treatment of Islamists at home versus Islamists abroad. I mean, in a way, it's been a wonderfully convenient package through which the Syrians can maintain these instrumental relationships without undermining its legitimacy or exposing it to questions about hypocrisy or double standards.
But, you know, but I don't see that as very different from any of the neighbors. I mean, if you take Saudi Arabia, America's best friend in the Middle East after Israel, Saudi Arabia destroys al-Qaeda at home. And yet, it supports lots of fundamentalist groups, whether it's in Iraq, whether it was in Afghanistan, that have close associations with al-Qaeda, if not al-Qaeda itself. And it doesn't want to destabilize its regime, and yet it wants to work with non-state actors that can fight. And, you know, I mean, I suppose I just don't see a big difference in that sense.
I'm not sure. I think Syria behaves pretty much like any other state. But that doesn't imply that the direction it's seeking to move the region or its objectives, its foreign policy interests, align with those of states whose behavior is similar to Syria's. I mean, there are still significant differences there.
Right.
I think in the Saudi case, your characterization was probably truer maybe 5 or 10 years ago than it is today.
But in Iraq, it's gearing up, I think, to support groups that America's quite frightened
non-state
of.
Actors? Or you think the Saudis are going to play an active role in...
I don't know.
In revitalizing
sort of
violent Sunni militias in Iraq?
No, this is clearly what Maliki in the leaks, WikiLeaks, is accusing the Saudis of. Now, I don't believe the Saudis are doing that yet, although individual Saudis may be fighting groups there, and that was the case, of course, with the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. You know, I don't know the Saudis have gotten to that point yet, but it's certainly a threat, and the Saudi... fairly senior Saudi officials have articulated that threat in the past. I don't know if they're doing it yet, but they certainly are holding that cudgel in the air.
But I mean, you know, the bigger question in terms of our topic is that this is a style of managing foreign policy that we see more broadly.
Let me return to this question about conservatism and radicalism. And moderates versus extremists, because I think it's fundamental, and it's certainly the way the United States has cast the Middle East, as the America is on the side of moderation and status quo, and Syria is on the side of revolution and provocation. And let me just describe Syria for a second as a really very conservative country in the region, conservative in the following way. I mean, there are aspects to it that are not conservative, but there are some that are very conservative. And one of those, I suppose, is that Syria has had the least internal turmoil of most of the states in the region. Syria looks at the world. If you're from Damascus, you've got 500,000 Palestinian refugees in Syria. You've got close to 1 million Iraqi refugees in Syria. You've got Armenian refugees, you've got Syrians.
Sure, I don't think there's any question that Syria understands the value of strong government.
No, but those have been shoved into Syria through revolution amongst its neighbors. Revolution, if it looks at Iraq and Palestine, Syria sees those as revolutions that were in many ways stimulated by the United States, by the destruction of the Iraqi state and by promoting the creation of Israel and the destruction of a Palestinian.
You know, again, Josh, I think you're presenting a kind of a perspective that reflects only a slice of Syria's historical experience.
That's true, but that's the way Syrians look at it.
Right, but there isn't any question that the current regime in Syria traces its own origins back to a very revolutionary political movement, that it is anchored in an ideology of radical egalitarianism. I mean, I've called it populist authoritarianism, but it is all about managed processes of economic and social development in which the state plays a central role. The state is a secular actor. It's the dominant actor governed by a single ruling party with very radical ambitions in terms of what it wants to achieve socially. And that Syria was involved, along with other Arab states, in efforts to consolidate that particular ideology as the foundation for governance across the Arab world in the 50s and 60s.
True. Today...
Now there's no question that it's retreated from that. And I think I'm not disagreeing with your characterization of Syria's foreign policy as fundamentally conservative in the sense that it wants stability, it wants strong governments able to control populations, that it's worried about the proliferation of ideas that it views as potentially threatening to the status quo, including those of George Bush. But there is this other side of Syria. I mean, this notion that the pathway for achieving Syria's goals is resistance, is rejection, is continued threat of military action.
Well, let's look at that that resistance. Resistance for Syria is about getting back to Golan Heights. And Israel has occupied this big hunk of Syrian territory since 1967, and international law is pretty clear that it belongs to Syria. Israel, in 81, annexed this territory. Now, the two sides...
It didn't formally annex. It extended Israeli law to the territory. I don't think Israel has ever formally annexed the Golan, the way it did Jerusalem, for instance.
Well...
But anyway, go ahead.
Okay. Today, both Netanyahu and the foreign minister of Israel have said that they're not going to give it back and that they will offer Syria peace for peace and not land for peace. Now, let's say that's a starting negotiating position. But for Syria, Syria clearly lacks leverage. It can't get the Golan Heights back because it's too weak. It has nothing to offer Israel. Whenever you sit in a room with Israeli defense officials, they say, what do we get out of making peace, or giving back
Right.
Golan? They don't get anything from their point of view, very little, because they have contained Hezbollah. They have contained Hamas. And they're irritants, for sure. They would like to have them gone, but they're not threatening enough for Israel to give back Syria. So Syria's looking for a way, and that's why we're reading all about Syria giving better missiles and more technology to Hezbollah, which is causing...
I agree with you completely on
so,
that. I agree with you. I mean, this...
But this is about getting back land. This is a little land struggle. It's not a giant ideological, revolutionary ideological. Syria's abandoned socialism. It's abandoned pan-Arabism, really. I mean, it still has it around in name, but there was an important debate a few years ago about whether they should get rid of the Ba'ath, the national
right.
Ba'ath, the wing of the Ba'ath Party, which was pan-Arab.
The Ba'ath Party being the sort of dominant single ruling party in Syria since 1963.
And so yeah, Syria, in that sense, I think, they have accepted, the Bashar al-Assad's big future goal for Syria is what he calls this 5 C's plan, which is making Syria a entrepot. Between
to
Turkey
put Syria,
and
Syria is sort
east
of
west.
Right. It's located geographically in the middle of
and
these 5 C's.
It's all about trade.
C's.
It's about trade,
yeah.
And globalization, and joining the world system, and making Syria competitive. It's not about socialism or redistribution or revolution. It's about joining the world. And it's real bone to pick with America. The reason it has sanctions on by America, and America prescribes it as a terrorist state, is because it wants the Golan back, and in order to get that, it feels that it has to hurt Israel, or else Israel's not going to get that. Now, the United States, and we saw this in the WikiLeaks, the senatorial, the congressional delegations go over there and they say, don't. We will get you the Golan back if you cut your ties with Iran and Hezbollah and stop supporting these Islamist groups. We'll help you get your land back. Now, Bashar al-Assad, the president, looks at these congressmen and thinks, you're lying to me, or else you just don't understand America, because he believes...
Well, I think they tend
it.
To view one another as equally honest and equally transparent.
Okay, I'm sure they do, but I mean...
There are American officials who've come back from visits to Syria fuming that Bashar al-Assad, the president, has lied to their faces. So, I mean, the relationship is characterized by mistrust. But you're right in the bigger point, John. I mean, you're right that the Syrians are working to mobilize every lever they can in pursuit of their return of the Golan along terms that they view as acceptable, and which I think, you know, reasonable Israelis understand as reasonable as well.
Yes, they do.
But in the process, you know, they have wrapped themselves in this network of relationships with actors who the U.S. views as beyond the pale. They've adopted policies that are reinforcing the adversarial relationship between the U.S. and Syria. I mean, look at the effort to return an American ambassador to Syria. The ambassador was recalled in 2005 after the Hariri assassination.
But Stephen, the alternative and so, is the PLO, right? The PLO is the anti-Syria. It went and shook hands with the Israelis and says, I want peace. I want my land back. I'll do what you need. Give me my land back. Obama said, stop settlements. Do all these things to the Israelis. What's happened to him? We just, just yesterday.
Well, you know, look, if we want to compare the relative success of the Fatah, the PLO strategy versus the Syrian strategy, I'm not sure which of those
I would like to take. They're both losers.
Yeah.
But the point that I'm making is, you're saying that Syria is pursuing the wrong strategy because it's not being nice to the United States and it's supporting groups that America calls terrorist groups.
No, I'm not saying I'm not making a judgment claim about whether it's right or wrong. I mean, we can look at its effects. You know, we can look at its effects and draw conclusions. I don't disagree with you that Syria is using means and techniques and instruments that are common in statecraft. I think you're right about that as well. What I'm suggesting is that we can't look at Syria simply as a conservative, reactive state in a region whose fates are being driven from elsewhere. I think Syria has shaped its own position in the region, its own strategy, and its own standing in the international system are the product of Syrian behavior. That's what I'm suggesting. And I agree with you that it's instrumental. I think that has interesting implications for its support of groups like Hezbollah. I mean, what would happen, for instance, to Hezbollah the day after Syria signs an agreement with Israel and gets the Golan back?
What do you think?
I suspect that Hezbollah would come under significant pressure to climb down from its antagonistic policy toward Israel. The Syrians have said that the expectation is that if they sign a peace treaty, the Lebanese government will as well. Hezbollah is now in the Lebanese government. So I think the expectation is that on the Syrian side that Hezbollah is expendable. And probably that Hamas is expendable as well. And frankly, Josh, that's consistent with what you've been saying about Syria.
Right. No, I agree with you.
Do you think otherwise?
No, I think, you know, it'll be difficult. I mean, Syria, of course, in order to resist Israel, has painted itself into an ideological position, as any country does in these things. And it will be difficult to throw the Palestinians under the bus. And Syria says they're not going to do that. Now, of course, at the same time, they sort of imply they could do that. And
I don't know that there are many Palestinians who are looking to Syria for leadership on...
They don't. But they also are very happy, you know, that Syria is a pain in the ass for Israel. And most Palestinians I know, whether they can dislike the Assad regime, and certainly Assad has been bad at the PLO and to different Palestinian groups in the past as he's tried to control them. But at the same time, they appreciate that Syria is not, for example, Egypt, and that Syria has not just caved in and is still resisting.
No, I think that's true. I continue to hear when I travel around the Arab world that kind of view of Syria expressed by people all over. I mean, I was in Yemen in September, and a senior government official was very admiring about Syria because they said it was strong and it pursued a strong policy. So clearly, that approach resonates.
And but I agree with you. Syria would also have a hard time with Hezbollah because Hezbollah performs two functions for Syria in Lebanon. One is resistance against Israel, which is the most important for Syria, and that requires arms. Two is that Hezbollah is, in many ways, Syria's influence in Lebanon. It's certainly the most important part of Syria's influence in Lebanon. And so Syria has to keep Hezbollah sweet, whether the Arab-Israeli conflict is solved or not, and whether the Golan comes back. But it could try to transform its relationship to the Shiite community.
Sure, and I mean, here the very interesting question is, just to get back to an earlier part of our discussion, concerns the nature of the Syrian-Hezbollah relationship. I think we agree it's instrumental. I think we agree that if Syria and Israel were to reach a settlement about the return of the Golan, Syria's relationship with Hezbollah would change. I think what you're saying, I also agree with, that it might push Hezbollah and lead Hezbollah to think more critically about the benefits of its ties to Syria. And for that purpose, it seems to me, in part, Hezbollah has cultivated a second patron, Iran.
Right. And it would bring tensions between Iran and Syria.
It would cause extraordinary tensions. And I think we can agree that the very quick end of the efforts to bring a U.S. ambassador back to Damascus was probably seen by Iran as a very positive step. There's no question that the timing of the visit back in the spring of Iran's President Ahmadinejad to Damascus for a summit with President Bashar al-Assad and with the head of Hezbollah, why am I blanking on
Nasrallah.
His name, for God's sake, that's terrible.
Yeah, Nasrallah.
That summit in the spring at exactly the time that the Senate was considering returning an ambassador to Damascus had very damaging effects, and I think we can probably view those effects as at least partly intended by Iran.
And I think Syria too. Syria was showing which side it was on, and I think Syria believed that America was not serious about Golan and Israel and other things, and it was demonstrating that it was not going to be lured into some sort of process that would go nowhere. And I think it feels very vindicated by that, by the way that things have turned out for the PLO and in Palestine. Now,
but there's a bit of a self-fulfilling
there
prophecy.
There is. There's no doubt about it.
I mean, if the Syrians had created a context
that made it harder
for Congress to refuse to return an ambassador to Damascus.
That's true, but Obama's backed away from everything. He's backed away from the Palestinians. He backed away from his monetary policy. He's not going to champion the Syrians in any way. I just don't see. I'm not hopeful for the future of U.S.-Syrian relations. And we saw in the WikiLeaks...
But, you know, Josh, even on that front, the U.S. Institute of Peace sent a group to Damascus last year. The group was able to meet with the president. And what he was advocating, and I only reference it because it's been a common theme in these sorts of meetings he's held, is that he wants an instrumental relationship with the U.S. as well. He wants a pragmatic relationship with the U.S. He understands that there are differences of opinion, that there are tensions in the relationship. But his line to the delegation from my institute is, look, we could find 40% to 50% of the issues between us on which we might be able to achieve some common ground. Let's focus on those first.
But they can never get to go because, I mean, as we saw in the WikiLeaks...
Well, okay, why can't they ever... I tend to think that it's because of resistance within Damascus to the idea of an improved relationship with the U.S. that we rarely get to go on this.
I don't think so.
I think it's because Syria always wants to keep all its options open and has been very reluctant to commit to any kind of significant shift in its foreign policy orientation.
Right. Well,
and so it got cold feet and it pulled back.
I don't read that.
That's how I would read
here
it.
Here's the deal that goes sour, it seems to me, every time. And we saw this in the WikiLeaks. There was a particularly good one last year in which Miqdad, the deputy foreign minister of Syria, and Ali Makhlouf, head of intelligence, were sitting down and talking to Daniel Benjamin, the U.S. coordinator
right.
of counterterrorism. And the two of them, here's from the little teeny one-sentence quote. Miqdad stated, convincing the Syrian people to support cooperation with the U.S. will hinge on progress on economic sanctions against Syria, bringing back the ambassador, and lifting these sanctions. Now, Benjamin said that the Obama administration viewed counterterrorism as a vital concern, but, unlike predecessors, it did not see counterterrorism as something that was separate from the rest of U.S. foreign policy, or the sole driver of U.S. foreign policy. So what he meant is, what Assad was asking for, and the Syrians were asking for, is, America, you normalize relationships with us. Don't demonize us for supporting Hezbollah and Hamas, and for fighting Israel for our land. And we will work with you to get Al-Qaeda and to arrest Baath, you know, Iraqi types, and to the other things. Syria and America responded, we're not going to do that. Our Israeli policy is more important than going after Al-Qaeda.
But it wasn't just our Israeli policy at
that
point.
It's Hezbollah and Hamas.
It was Syria's position. Well, it was Syria's position in a network of alliances with actors who are so profoundly anti-American that to simply normalize relationships, our relationship with Damascus, without addressing those concerns, I think would have been politically impossible for the
U.S. But that's what I'm saying. It's politically impossible. Syria is not going to help the U.S. hunt down Al-Qaeda and normalize its relations with the U.S. at the same time as the U.S. has economic sanctions, won't send an ambassador, and calls Syria a terrorist state. Syria believes its support for Hezbollah and Hamas is legitimate self-defense and an attempt to liberate its territories, which it sees America is helping Israel to keep. But here's
an interesting issue. It's an interesting dynamic in terms of this bigger question we've been touching on now and then about Syrian support for Islamists. There is a fairly significant price that Syria pays for maintaining those relationships. I know that the conventional thinking in Damascus is that the benefits outweigh the costs, but I don't think anyone would argue that Syria pays a price. It pays a significant economic price.
Economic,
political, in terms of... And the question really is, the meaningful question from the Syrian perspective, is which set of strategies and relationships is going to maximize our opportunities to achieve our core national interest. And it seems to me pretty clear that if you look at the course of Syrian diplomacy over the last 30, 40 years, going back beyond Bashar, those moments in which Syria came closest to achieving its national interests were those in which it showed itself willing to make compromises with respect to its support for Islamist non-state actors, with respect to its standing as a rejectionist regime in relation
to
U.S. interests.
But Syria was willing to do that when the United States was serious about getting the Golan back, and that was under Clinton, and we saw it almost
That's right.
But the U.S. is not serious
right.
about that now, at least it hasn't shown any seriousness.
Let's talk about this notion of seriousness then for a minute. I mean, what is it in your sense that would demonstrate seriousness? The answer can't be that the U.S. has to be prepared to accept Syrian terms and conditions for reestablishing the relationship. If that's what it takes, then I think the idea of bridging differences is really going to be very hard. So what does it mean to be serious?
I guess it means, what Rabin said and Barak seemed to indicate, which was that we can give back the Golan for peace. And the United States cannot make Israel do that. Only Israel is going to do that. It's clear that U.S. policy is not about pressuring Israel. Now, so then it's up to Israel. And Israel doesn't have a coalition, political coalition at the present time that's interested in doing that. And so things are at a dead end. And Syria looks to America to pressure Israel rather than to, mm-hmm. veto UN resolutions on this issue. And America's not going to do that. And so in that sense...
It seems to me that some sort of reasonable definition of seriousness is to first provide indication of a willingness to redefine the relationship and to move it into more positive.
But why can't America
direction.
Do that? Why couldn't America?
I'm talking the U.S.-Syrian relationship. Absolutely, we can do that. And you know, it's to indicate, to signal that certain sanctions issues are up for discussion in the event that Syrian behavior changes in areas of interest to the United States. It's a public recognition of Syria as a potential partner for the U.S. and a commitment to engagement. I mean, we saw all that stuff. Now, you're saying that Obama was never serious, that he would never intended to follow
He may
through.
Intended, but he couldn't do
I think,
it. He had to give up.
I think that's...
He became
that's,
you know, he intended to, you know, not to renew tax cuts for the very rich, and he did it anyway. I mean, he intended to do a lot of things, but he couldn't do it. He just doesn't have the clout in Congress. Congress is against, in any way, Congress is against... making
but one of the part of the calculus for Syria has to be, and the Syrians are smart enough to know this, they have very able diplomats in Washington. Part of the calculus for Syria is how do you create a political environment that's supportive of efforts by the administration to change, to transform the relationship. And that is within Syria's control to do.
Well, I don't think Syria believes that. I think they're trying to do it.
Well, I think this is an issue. Yeah. I think the fact that Syria doesn't believe it is an important issue.
How do you think you get Congress to support giving back, to put pressure on Israel to give back to everyone? How would you do that if you were Imad Mustafa in Washington, the Syrian ambassador? How would you go about trying to get a coalition of American politicians who are willing to lean on Israel?
I think I would suggest that the U.S. faces some very significant challenges across the Middle East, that there has been a dynamic in terms of the balance of power in the region that is working against U.S. interests, that is creating significant new threats to American security, that Syria is the linchpin in any potential effort to reverse that dynamic and to shift the momentum in a way that would dramatically improve American security globally and in the region, and that Syria is willing to undertake those kinds of changes, but it requires the support of the U.S. in its efforts to secure the return of the Golan along lines that both Israel and Syria, again, if you find that reasonable Israeli, acknowledge have to be the starting point for a real settlement. I think that's what you offer. I mean, this is... You know, if you're a spoiler, but you're not able to set out a vision of what the world would look like if you were to make those kinds of changes, then you really are backed into a corner. And I think then the Syrian regime is really creating its own...
I would see that the Syrians believe that they've made that offer. They've said, we want peace with Israel. We will make a lot of concessions on defense, on water, on whatever Israel wants, if we can get back the Golan. And they've said, Syrian authorities at almost every level have said, we will change our relationship with Hamas and Hezbollah if we have peace. We'll no longer be trying to support enemies of Israel.
I'm not sure I've heard that from Syria recently. What I've heard, if you go back over the last 18 months or so, are interviews with President Assad in which he has said that the Israelis should not expect that a return of the Golan will lead to full peace or normalization of relations, in which he said that the Israelis should not expect that the return of the Golan will involve our redefining our relationship with Iran or with Hezbollah, that those are not part of what should be a bilateral discussion over a border, not about serious strategic choices in the region. It doesn't seem to me that he's been at all prepared, or that Syrian officials have been at all prepared to make available as an outcome a dramatic realignment of Syria's regional posture and its foreign policies. It hasn't been willing to do that. And that poses a dilemma for the U.S. You know, I mean, does it accept those terms as adequate starting conditions for redefining U.S.-Syria relationship?
Syria signed on to the Fahad plan, the Saudi plan, that said, you return the land, you're going to get peace from every Arab actor. Syria signed on to that. Syria has, you know, Syria has a number of officials have talked, when you ask about Hezbollah or Iran, Syria can't stand up and say, I'll throw my friends under the bus if I can have peace. Because you won't have any more friends if you do that. That would make everybody smile on the other side. And it's what ultimately the United States and Israel are working for, is to pry apart this coalition that it is confronting. Now, at the same time, Syria has made, I think, important statements saying that they would be willing to modify, that they would make it a strategic, the exact phrase that they use all the time is they would change their strategic posture, something like that. This is the sort of wording they use, which is vague enough so that they don't have to insult Iran and Hezbollah, and at the same time can indicate that they're willing to make.
But changes. All of their behavior, Josh, over the past year has suggested that they're not committed.
That's true, because they believe they gave up. When Obama came out saying he was going to stop settlement, I think that was a big test for the Syrians. They were hopeful. Hoff was sent over there.
Fred Hoff. Fred, this is a senior diplomat working on Syria issues.
And Mitchell was appointed. And there was in Jones in the National Security Council. They were quite optimistic for a while in the beginning. And they're of course very cynical, but they said, let's wait and see what happens. And they made various little concessions. They tried to do the border with Lebanon. They made a bunch of nice things. They invited U.S. high intelligence and military people to come and talk about Iraq. And they had a number of these meetings. But then Obama backed away from putting pressure on Israel to stop settlement process. He got this sort of fakey freeze, and that was good. But there were still big settlements growing. And then the Syrian, I felt a definite shift amongst the Syrian officialdom. And they said, it's not going to work. There are still people like John Kerry and so forth, Senator John Kerry, come over here and tell us they're serious, Obama's serious, people in the administration are serious, and they're going to get this peace with Israel. But increasingly, nobody believed it anymore. I don't think anybody in Washington believes it. You can't find one article that says they think Obama's going to make any headway in this peace. It's pretty much dead. And that's what the Syrians are reading. So what they're doing is they are keeping their fuel dry, they're making Hezbollah stronger, they're waiting for the next confrontation because they believe that's what's going to happen. That's the only thing that's going to change the status quo. And what the Syrians are really looking toward, I think, in the next 10 years is the rise of China, the rise of Russia, that Iran is going to somehow escape from this sanction regime and it's going to prosper, that Turkey is going to move increasingly towards Syria and Iran, and that America is going to diminish that countries, the BRIC countries like
India
and Brazil.
I think you've captured the ideal trajectory of global politics from
the Syrian point
Damascus perspective very well. I think that's exactly what they're betting.
And Israel and America are betting on the fact that Syria has got a sclerotic regime that will not make the transformation to liberal economics, that will not really engage the global community, that will fail economically, and that it will
in some ways, Josh, I think the U.S. diagnosis may be less appealing than that from a Syrian perspective, because there's a constant question about whether, from an American perspective, Syria really matters that much.
Right.
I'm not sure that there's a strong voice in Washington that would argue that we need to take Syria more seriously than we do. Absent sort of indications on the Syrian side that it's willing to move a bit in our direction.
Well, this is, that's the American calculations. The Palestinian issue is really over. It's going to remain an irritant for America in the Middle East, but that ultimately, if settlements go on, if Israel ends up, sitting on top of Palestinians for the next 30 years with this grinding underneath, that it'll be a little bit of sand there, but it's not going to... that relations in the greater Middle East and the Islamic world can move ahead, and that countries like Syria
I think that defines a perspective here. I think there is at the same time...
there are people who are worried.
Well, look at the comment by David Petraeus last summer when he acknowledged the linkage between the unresolved status of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and U.S. security and the rest of the
Arab
world.
But what happened to David Petraeus?
I'm sorry?
What happened to David Petraeus?
What do you mean what happens?
The next day.
He's probably going to be the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
Okay, but next week, Secretary of State Gates stood up and he said, nobody
Secretary
wearing
Defense
uniform
Gates.
Believes in linkage. Nobody in uniform and nobody in my office believes that American soldiers are being killed because we have not resolved the Arab-Israeli conflict. And he said, anybody who does not belong in this service. And he shut David Petraeus down. David Petraeus went and gave a long interview to some neocon guy saying, I never said it. I don't believe it.
Yeah.
It's not true. He denied it. And
everybody snapped shut. But I think whether officials here are trying to manage that perspective the way they're trying to manage, you know, the WikiLeaks now that the horse is out of the barn.
I don't think anybody believed it. You know, that's the policy. I mean, that's what
yes, of course it is the policy. But look, we've been talking for 45 minutes. Let's tackle one more question directly related to Syrian support for Islamist groups. In your you know, the way you've spun Syria's vision for the future, which I thought reflected quite accurately the way Syrians are thinking about how the world is moving. Where does the support for these non-state actors fall? I mean, what one of the ways to read what you said is that the Syrians are waiting for another war between Hezbollah and Israel, following which they intend to clean up in the Golan.
No, I don't think they intend to clean up. They don't. They look at it like Sadat of Egypt.
Not clean up. I mean benefit in terms of capture the gains of a conflict without actually participating.
They were very much hoping that 2006 would be their Suez crossing. This would be the counterpart of what Sadat did in 1973 when he crosses Suez and he scared the Israelis. And eventually this led to Camp David Accords, 1979, in which he got back to Sinai and the Suez was opened again with American support. But by scaring Israel, he got respect militarily, and he was able to improve his negotiating position. And the Syrians look at Hezbollah that way, and they hope that the 2006 war would sober up the Israelis and make them come to the table. And first they thought they were vindicated because Israel did open up negotiations through Turkey in Ankara.
But that didn't last.
No, and it wasn't because they don't because Syria is not
Hezbollah
Egypt.
Is not
Syria
Egypt.
Is not Egypt. And Syria has got a very weak hand. And Hezbollah was seriously chastened, I think.
I think so, too. I take a somewhat, a contrary view on this, but I actually think the Israelis, in many respects, did win that encounter.
But I think that's why Syria is hoping, and I think he's expecting, that there will be another confrontation with Hezbollah. And, of course, that has nothing but dangers for Syria.
That's my view as well. And frankly,
but otherwise they've got to give up the Golan. Look at if they do nothing and they let Israel
get away with it. See, this is the really interesting question for Syria in terms of our topic. You know, at what point does their support for Hezbollah cross a threshold in which the costs outweigh the benefits? And if they're looking at Hezbollah and its potential to wage war against Israel as a benefit, It seems to me they're making a really fundamental mistake. And if that's the case, then it also seems to me that they have to begin working on a plan B or a strategy B or some other set of relationships in which they can work to build leverage the way they've worked to build it across the Lebanese-Israeli border, but from a very different direction. And so far, the Syrians themselves have not seemed to share that diagnosis.
Yeah, it's hard to see. You know, I agree with you. It's very difficult to game this out in the future and see how Syria is going to get back to Golan. I don't, I can't go that far in the future. I'm not that good of a chess player. But, you know, when I talk to Syrians and I say this to Syrian officials, I say, you know, why don't you just give it up? Forget about the Golan. Get peace with Israel. Get America off your back, get rid of sanctions, and get your people rich. That's going to be the best revenge for anybody. And they look at me, they've heard this before, but they say, we can't do that. And then they say, you know, Syria and our not making peace with Israel, we're like the pilot light in a stove. We can't go to war, we can't turn that pilot in, but we can keep it lit. And then maybe in some future generation, there'll be a chance when we can turn it on again. You know, we're not going to, you got to keep it alive. And I've heard that from so many people. You've got to keep it. It's right. What we're doing is the right thing to do, and we're not going to give up on this. And
well, you know, I think I think that's posing the alternatives in a particularly stark way, because I certainly understand the depth of Syrian commitment to the return of the Golan. That's not something that they view as an issue on which they can compromise.
Some do.
But Josh, if and you know, maybe we could sort of wrap up on this. If it means that they see only one pathway forward for them to secure their national interest, which is linked to further strengthening Hezbollah, encouraging Hezbollah in its more sort
aggressive
of adversarial, aggressive posture toward Israel, and perhaps even facilitating a conflict that they think would change the diplomatic dynamics.
Give leverage.
You know, it seems to me that we really are seeing some of the more potentially damaging side effects of this instrumental support of a movement.
It worked
like
for
Hezbollah.
Egypt, and it worked for, you know, you've got to get a better hand. You've got to build a bigger, better military.
It worked for Egypt, Josh, under such dramatically different conditions.
And America wanted Egypt to get it. I mean, America paid Israel an enormous amount of money and pushed on Israel hard to do this deal.
And I don't think those conditions exist.
No, they don't exist for Syria.
And so what does that say, then, about the instrumental value of that relationship, I guess? You know, that to me, that's the question to end on. The Syrians clearly feel that there is sufficient strategic benefit from that relationship to make it worthwhile.
America and Israel are going to decline in the future. America and Israel are betting that they can roll over Syria and the Palestinians. And I think that's the bleak picture that we're left with. And I'm not optimistic about an understanding being made. I think both sides are keeping their powder dry, and they don't really see a way to resolve this.
I'm afraid I don't either. I think we may arrive at our pessimistic conclusions from different directions, but I think we both end up there at the end of the day.
Well, Stephen, it's been a pleasure talking with you about this.
Likewise, Joshua, I appreciate taking the time, and we'll continue the discussion
very good
at some other point. All right,
yep.
Take care.
Bye-bye, all.
Bye.